So it's of course the biggest concern of everybody today. We're having this barbarian attack of this caveman, and I don't know what to tell. What we try to understand today is A, the dynamics of war, and B, the kind of global context and Ukrainian occupation. Would you guide us through, in your understanding of imperialism, the strategies, how Ukraine dealt with them, and generally, how is it going now?
Thank you for this question. I'm glad that we have this conversation also in the framework of our project on the war, on the wars in Europe. Sadly, this is a kind of a new addition, a new situation that will add to this project. I wish it would have never happened, but it's happening. It's really something unthinkable and unbelievable. I would say that the coverage in the media, which is quite extensive, quite good, cannot cover the things that happen on the ground. It's like a shocking situation, like a nightmare, essentially, from which you want to wake up, and you can't, and you know that you will never wake up from this nightmare. Certainly, people who never experienced something like that can never really understand what is going on, and probably people in Georgia can understand us better than many other, if any other, European nation. And I think, as never before, we understand the people of Georgia these days. Yes, if we judge from media, we probably can see the war in Ukraine as coming out of blue, out of sudden. And indeed, it was something unthinkable. Indeed, it is a real huge murderous war in Europe for decades. Of course, there was the war in Georgia, there was the war in Armenia, which are somehow in the same line, but the scale of this war is really huge. For us Ukrainians, however, it's not really like, a peak on the oscillogram that emerges out of nothing. For us, it's just an escalation of the war through which we have been living through since 2014. So that for us, it's not the beginning of the war. It's just the continuation of the war. It's really a stage of the war that we never expected to happen. At the same time, the framework for this war, rationale, if you want, it's really strange to speak about the rationale of the war, because there cannot be. We understand that it's kind of insane, illogical to assume any rationale in the war, and still there is one. Something that I try to kind of to grasp, to understand, and I think we try to do this in this project together. So this underpinning of the war, ideological frame, I prefer to call it ideological frame of the war, remains the same. The actors remain the same, including Mr. Putin, who waged the initial stage of this war in 2014. On the one side, and on the other side, the Ukrainian people, who are the other part of the actors in this war. My hermeneutical approach to this war is that it's not really a war in the classical sense, given especially that it has never been declared formally. So, from the Putin's perspective, it's a special operation in Ukraine to denazify Ukraine. For us, for me personally, it's just a continuation of the Maidans. I call it the Maidan number three, which continues a series of public manifestations which have took place in Ukraine. Arguably, it can be also called Maidan number four, because some people say that the Maidans, the series of the Maidans, started with the students' revolution. It is also called the Granite Revolution. It took place in the early 90s when the students came to protest against the communist regime in Ukraine, and they managed, well, to some extent, to change the political climate in Ukraine. And certainly they laid out the foundations for the further public revolts, including the one in 2004, known as the Orange Revolution. Then the Revolution of Dignity 2014, and now I would call that the events of 2022 is just the kind of climax, apotheosis of the series of the public manifestations, with the same purpose: to protect the transformations within the society, the Ukrainian society, the transformations that happen as an evolution, I would say. So the Maidans as such, they are not really revolutions. They are the means to protect the evolution within the Ukrainian society towards democratization, and I would call towards the ideal of republicanism, a model, a political model, which is opposite, incompatible with the political model promulgated and promoted and protected by Putin, the monarchical model, the autocratic model. And yes, again, we have to protect our ideals, the evolution that is going on within Ukraine. So that would be my very broad framework to explain, the hermeneutical frame, if you want, to explain what is going on. And of course, probably you will ask in the conversation about the religious dimension, because I think it is still strong, as it was very strong in the previous Maidans, so it is strong in this Maidan, number three.
Yeah, and of course, it's interesting, I mean, how Putin, when he was announcing this in a very confusive interview, which was cut off at the end, and also when it's kind of the meeting of this Federal Council, he was referring to some religious components, the idea of Russian world in a way, and you wrote that in the blog for our Religion and Praxis. So I wonder if you can elaborate on the Russian world idea, how that works on the level of soft power politics, on the level of religious dimension of it. And you theorize that in your book on orthodoxies, political orthodoxies, in a way. You wrote it extensively in other places, but I'm wondering, how would that be a kind of a feature by which Russian foreign policy justifies this war, and under which it maybe framed this war?
Yeah, well, I agree, and certainly you are correct in mentioning, referring to the Russian world ideology, which I think is the framing ideology for the entire Putin's regime. I should say that the Putin's regime did not start with this ideology. It did not, it was not propelled to power by this ideology, but certainly it realized at some point that this ideology can be useful for this regime to preserve itself. So it is an ideology of self-preservation or self-reproduction for Putin's regime. I've been speaking and writing about this ideology since it actually was adopted by the Russian church and elaborated upon by the Russian church. I worked then in the Russian church and was very close to those people who started refurbishing this ideology, which they borrowed actually from the liberal circles in the Russian society in the 1990s. The original idea of the Russian world was that we believe, they said, a group of political scientists, including people like Shchedrinsky and his followers, the so-called methodological school, I think, in the Russian social philosophy, if you want. So they essentially assumed that the core of modern Russia at that time, in the 90s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, is weak, cannot sustain itself, cannot provide itself with meanings. Why should we exist? And it doesn't have cadres, people who would help this core to develop, to sustain itself, and to integrate into the international community. So they realized that the brightest people, Russians, they had to leave, were forced or decided to leave Russia and to go outside to the periphery of Russia, as it were, to the Western countries, to the East, wherever. And they constitute essentially the brain of the Russian civilization. That was the point of the original Russian world. So they suggested that in order to sustain the Russian civilization, this civilization needs to use its peripheral powers, concentrated on the periphery, sometimes outside Russia. And they need to bring the potentiality and the skills of the periphery of those Russian brains spread across the universe, across the world, around Russia, to make the Russian existence meaningful again. So it was essentially a centripetal movement, ideology. Then in the 2000s, something happened to this ideology. It was reused and, as I said, refurbished. And it received a completely different dynamics. And now this dynamics was centrifugal, that people began to believe that, no, it's not the periphery which is the strength of the Russian world, of the Russian civilization. It is the center, people who live in the center. And they are able to produce ideas and project power to the outside, to the West. And they are able to change the world around this Russian world, to reshape it according to the ideals of the Russian world. So this ideology was centrifugal. As I said, it was designed to project ideas, Russian ideas and values, what they call. They would come later on to call traditional values to the world outside. The crucial role in this transformation of the dynamics, of this U-turn of the dynamics, was played by the Russian church. And I think at the moment when this dynamics changed its direction, I believe it became dangerous. It became an ideological frame for the neo-imperial project. And you were right by referring to this imperialism, this imperial project, which we observe nowadays. I should mention that I had friends in the early 2000s when this ideology began emerging, who were quite liberal in the church and open-minded. And they're still open-minded. And I was quite surprised that they were kind of advocating for the liberal empire. Yes, they wanted it liberal, but still they wanted it to be an empire. And this idea of an empire is very much pertinent, I believe, to the mentality among the figures, including, you know, the intellectuals in the Russian church who contributed to the production of this formation of this ideology of the Russian world. And of course, as long as the Putin's regime became more conservative or looked for non-liberal patterns of existence, the Russian church came to serve him and to offer him ideas which are conservative, and they articulated those ideas in the terms of the traditional values. And also connected it with the ideology of the Russian world. So now the Russian world was not the world of peripheries. It was the world of the center, of the core of the Russian civilization that had the so-called spiritual staples, духовные скрепы, as it was called, which would contain the sustain the integrity of the Russian society, and moreover, to project the ideas, these principles of sustainability of the Russian society to the outside. And they became a tool of the reintegration, as they believed, of the former Soviet territories back to the neo-Russian, neo-empire of Putin. That's how this kind of combination of elements happened. The imperial project on the one hand, and the Russian world as an ideology which was originally liberal, then became conservative and became kind of underpinning or became underpinned by the conservative agenda, and they together constituted this complex ideological mechanism which Putin uses now to pursue his goals.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I am of course wondering about the persons who are running these things. You mentioned in our blog about probably Putin. What does he even think? What kind of Christian is he, and what kind of theologies, I mean, he employs in a way? I mean, would you elaborate for the people who will be reading this more, like a little bit insight from your experience of working closely in the Russian church? What is the attitude towards him among the clergy, among what does the patriarch Kirill think of him, or how do these people see him, and how do you think, what kind of people he is? Who is Putin Christ, in a way?
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good way to put the question you want to ask. Just give me a second, I need to check out another meeting. It's going to happen, what time, don't want to miss it. Just one second. Yeah, we still have time. Right, yes. Yes, Putin himself, I believe initially, I don't know him personally, of course, and he didn't have many opportunities or didn't have much desire to disclose what he believes, really. I would assume that he didn't believe anything. He didn't have any ideological frame in his policies. Moreover, I think maybe in the beginning he had some kind of aversion to any ideology, because certainly it's very clear that he was frustrated with the communist ideology, even though he was a communist member of the Communist Party. But as most those small members of the Communist Party, he didn't believe in the ideals, he was just using them. And certainly his frustration is very clear. Like, for instance, this frustration is clear from his kind of landmark address, which he made on the 21st of February this year, 2022, before the open invasion to Ukraine, when he gave a long lecture on the way how he sees Russia and its place in the world. And I think this was one of really rare opportunities for us to peek into his mind, to open kind of his scalp and to look into his brain. And there he revealed, he disclosed that he hated, apparently, the communist ideology. So I believe at some point he was disappointed in any ideology. And then he was brought back to thinking ideologically. And that is my belief. This is my kind of hypothesis, if you want, by the church. It somehow interfered with his coming back to some sort of spirituality, which is another interesting and difficult topic to analyze, what sort of spirituality it was. And I tried to touch on this in my blog published with you. It can be another question, but what is important to understand now that he had some kind of spirituality. Some people say, and he did not kind of denounce those statements that the current Metropolitan of Pskov, Tikhon Shevkunov, was his spiritual father, even though I doubt that, but certainly Tikhon Shevkunov was interested and is interested in, you know, sustaining those rumors. And Putin never denounced them. Some other people who were close to Putin, like the now refugee dissident banker Pugachev, who fled to France from Putin's Russia, who was a very close friend, that probably he contributed very much to the initiation of Putin to some kind of Orthodox, or I would say quasi-Orthodox spirituality. He also made some disclosures, and he actually stated that this sort of orthodoxy by of Putin is very superficial. It's very much aligned to it. He's very much just using it without really practicing it. So my own take on it is that this kind of spirituality that Putin adopted in the process of his conversion to whatever it is, whatever kind of religion it is, concurred with this initiation back to the ideological framework. And this happened under the influence of some influential hierarchs of the Russian Church, I believe, including Patriarch Kirill himself, who played, I think, a key role in constructing or reconstructing this ideology of the Russian world, and in converting most of the Russian establishment, political establishment, to this ideology. So I think the church is a key player. I mean, at least the leadership of the Russian church, particularly represented by Patriarch Kirill, are key figures in making this ideology, producing this ideology, and making this ideology the main framework for the Russian policies during the last decade.
And a very good point here is that what sort of you were talking about this, his beliefs maybe in numerisms and those kind of things, like in 8th of August, 22nd of, these things are...
Not just 8th of August, it's 8th. Of
August 2028,
yes, in Georgia.
Exactly. Yeah. So there is this sense of this sort of the weird, at the end of the day, kind of this weird features of, I don't know, beliefs and system of beliefs, which are combined in this sort of mythological figure. And to go into the questions, which our readers probably appreciate, will be the global dimensions of this war. I mean, of course, we talked about it in a private setting with other colleagues and friends that, well, it's not about Ukraine. It's actually about the world, and it's about global human rights. And absolutely, there is no guarantee that the next time it will not be Warsaw or Stockholm. It's just a test, which is, again, if it fails, the next one will be something else. These are things actually we've been discussing everywhere. I'm wondering, what does it actually change? What does the occupation of Ukraine change in the grand scheme of things, in the kind of a bigger politics? And what's your take on this whole broader dimension of this war?
Yeah, well, I think that Putin thinks of himself as a global actor, quite apparent. I think no one will doubt it. And I would put it in more dramatic terms, his self-perception. And his take on history, because he has a historiosophy. He is a historiosophy, in a sense. He has his own philosophy of history. I would call it a myth of history, but it's a matter of taste, how one takes it. So he has ideas about what kind of, about a history. He has, certainly has envisaged for himself a place in this history. And he acts from the perspective of his seeing himself in this history. It's a very interesting kind of perspective, if you want. So he looks at himself as a historical figure in third person, if you want, from the perspective of a handbook in the Russian history, or global history, written by himself. And I believe to a great extent, he is a hostage of this vision. And what kind of handbook of history it is, we could conclude again from this address on the 21st of February, where he exposed very in much detail, I would say, his look at the history, his outlook at the history, the way how he sees it. And this is certainly a history which resembles somehow, if you want, well, Christian Christian scriptures. Like if you take Paul's statement to the Christians that your fight is not against the powers of this world. Your fight is against the demons, the demonic forces. So Paul suggested an outlook at the history where the global existential metaphysical evil tries to attack, you know, the global metaphysical goodness. It's like in Dostoevsky, who also like to stress that the history has this metaphysical dimension. So Putin somehow continues, I think, somehow this line, maybe not necessarily Paul's, but maybe Dostoevsky's or Ilyin's, whom he appreciates much more.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, sorry, you just mentioned this Ilyin. I mean, Ivan Ilyin, which was a very interesting figure. And again, as Tim Snyder argued, right, his influence was tremendous. I mean, if you just go and check the random quotes by Ivan Ilyin, the fact of the matter is that fascism is a redemptive excess of patriotic arbitrariness, you name it.
Yeah.
This prayer of the kind of nationalism intertwined with neutralizing enemy and sort of this KGB apparatchik sort of school conversations is amazing. And I'm wondering, what's your take on these influences also? What shaped him? And you mentioned Ivan Ilyin, who is absolutely a very important part.
Exactly. Well, and again, as everything that Putin does and thinks about, it's very superficial and fragmentary. He's not really trained in, you know, in humanities. And I wish he could be trained in humanities much better. And I'd like to make a footnote here apology in support of systematic humanitarian education, why it is needed, why not just physics or law or whatever are needed. Because if we don't have proper fundamental humanitarian education, we have people like Putin in power. Crazy people with very superficial ideas about humanities, but who are sure that they know it very well. So Putin, like with history, so with Ilyin, I believe, or the Russian religious philosophy of the time, of that era, has a very superficial understanding, I think, of those things. And certainly, Ilyin was an Orthodox thinker. He was also in a right-wing thinker. And again, it was not a unique thing. I identify this kind of layer of the Russian religious philosophy of the 20th century as the philosophy or theology, political theology of the 30s. Many political theologians in the 1930s made the same statements as Ilyin and believed in the same way. They believed in the collapse in the collapse of the corrupted left-wing ideologies like socialism or even more communism, and they looked for alternatives to those ideologies. And Ilyin, I think, what is most liked by Putin in Ilyin is the idea that there is no a universal political model for all nations. Each nation has its own preferable models, and Russia is certainly is more in favor of monarchical model. And again, Ilyin stressed that he's not talking about the traditional hereditary monarchy of the Romanovs in Russia. It can be any sort of monarchical rule, meaning one man rule. It can be an elected person endorsed by someone like Hitler, who was elected democratically. So I think this is an idea that appeals to Putin, certainly. And this combination of political ideas, especially from the ideologies of the 30s, and religious ideas, plus a good deal of superstition, just plain religious superstition, contribute and play their role in the formation of a very interesting worldview of Putin. His kind of world, which consists of the elements of religion, politics, philosophy, history. It's very eclectic. It's very postmodernistic, if you want. It's non-systematic. If you start analyzing what he believes, you understand it's just nonsense. I mean, it doesn't make sense if you treat it as, you know, as a specialist, as a scholar in those fields. But they work very good for ordinary people. In this sense, I believe Putin is a populist. He's quite a populist. And I think there was a turn in Putin's political kind of evolution from one role to another role. One role that he played in the beginning, essentially after he was promoted to power, propelled to power after the resignation of Yeltsin, was the role, let me say, like Arabic sheikhs. He was an Arabic sheikh whose point was the following. Look, I'm enlightened. I know how to do things right? Like they do it in the West, but my people cannot understand it. My people will want to destroy you, the West. I'm the person who can contain them. I'm the mediator between my people, whom I understand well, and they trust me, and you, the Western powers. So I'm like an enlightened, you know, absolutist leader who can manage my people, and I do not allow the evil powers within my people to, you know, to harm you. And then at some point, he changed to a different model that, okay, you want me to be a democratic leader to represent my people. I will not contain my people anymore. I will be speaking on their behalf. I will represent and channel their will as I understand it. And this understanding exactly, he doesn't, essentially Putin doesn't think about the Russian people high. But in the beginning, his point was, I want to contain this wild, sometimes evil substance of the Russian kind of psyche, right? Now he says, no, I'm going to represent it. I'm going to promote, to protect it. I'm going to speak and act on its behalf. Then at some stage, there was another transformation from thinking about the Russian people not high, and maybe assuming that the Russian psyche contains those evil demonic powers, like demons. Putin came to think in the dualistic terms, as I described in my blog, that essentially the Russian psyche is like, you know, what the Stoics called, of course, Putin probably doesn't know Stoics and doesn't know Stoic philosophy. I try to articulate what he probably thought in the terms of the Stoic philosophy, what the Stoics thought of as the cosmic soul, you know, something rational, good, better than the rest of the world. And essentially, Putin, who originally believed that the West is wiser and kinder and better than Russia, came to believe the opposite, that the West is much worse than what Russia is. And he evolved to an extremal kind of perception of this dichotomization between Russia and world, dichotomization to which properly he was initiated or was strengthened in this initiation by reading the Russian religious philosophers, who also describe the world in those dichotomic terms, especially this controversy between the Slavophiles and the Westerners in the 19th century, which continued later on in the 20th century. And Ilyin was a part of this conversation about the role of the Russia, and he perceived the world in the same dichotomic terms as many Russian philosophers of his time did, even though, of course, he did not do this with those grief, dangerous political implications that Putin does. But essentially, Putin thinks in the same same lines of the of the old Slavophile Westerners dilemma: us or the West, us versus best, West, never us together with the West. And he began to think, he switched somehow from considering the West as wise and kind, and Russia being not wise and needing containment, to the opposite, that Russia is really the incarnation of the cosmic goodness, and the West as fundamentally, intrinsically distrustful, something bad, something evil that needs to be contained. Now, it's not the Russian people who needs to be contained, it's the West. And that's exactly what he tries to do in Ukraine. He believes that that Ukraine is possessed by the West, that Ukraine is a part of Russia, a piece of Russia, which became trapped in this Western framework. And essentially, what Putin fights is his earlier version of himself, because that's exactly what the early Putin believed, that it's good for Russia to be framed, you know, by the Western civilization, to be a part of the Western civilization. Well, it became, in a sense, by integrating, you know, through money and bribes and financial resources to the West, to the Western elites. But essentially, what Putin fights now, I want to repeat it, is what he earlier believed about Russia. And he sees it in Ukraine, and he really detests it. He tries to save Ukraine, and to save Ukraine from the mistakes that he himself did probably in the past. Yes, I know it may sound a bit speculative, but whatever we say about Putin will be a speculation. We will know about him, his beliefs, his ideas, including his religious, probably, ideas after he dies. And I wish we know about this sooner than later. But yes, it's unavoidable to speculate about him. And this is my take, my speculation about him.
And my question will be, I think you're running out of time because you have another meeting, so you have some time left. So what's the future of this whole thing? I mean, I in sociology, we of course hate to say go get into the futurism and foreseeing things. Nobody foresaw this invasion. Nobody was saying it's possible. And we were, of course, all deceived by this and weird maneuvering of Putin in a way. But actually what you're talking about makes a lot more sense in a way, if you look at it as more a guy who's obsessed with ideas. Because the way Western people look at it is a super pragmatic, rational actor. And invading Ukraine in such form actually does not make rational sense. And what you're saying is that, well, he believes in certain things obsessively. And those beliefs are in his kind of cosmology or epistemology of how things he understands and how he knows what he knows. And this is even more scary, because he's not easily to kind of prognosticate. He's unpredictable, because it's based on his beliefs of history and what you describe as kind of eclectic knowledge of different domains of humanity, but in a very unsystematic way. And then, of course, it creates an awful lot of misconceptions about how we, the people who study Russian studies or a region, kind of see what he will do or not. It is actually based on his assertions, so certain sort of idea systems in a way, which are again so out of this world at times and unsubstantiated. So my question will be, of course, based on what we said, what's kind of the global picture of this? What is the maybe the bigger sort of output to which it leads to, and what are the plausible scenarios of this whole thing? Because one thing I thought personally was that probably he will go on the model of North Korea and South Korea, and one part will be divided and isolated, being part of the Russian Empire or whatever form that is, and the other will be Alichina will be left to the other sort of influences. And maybe he wanted this isolation. Maybe he wanted to be not, he's not afraid of sanctions, and this doesn't come as a surprise, but actually he really wants the sanctions to be completely isolated and then going down each of these former Soviet countries and invade all of them separately and then basically restore this whole North Korea deal. So this is my theory, that probably this is where it's going to go, unless there is significant response which Putin considers as meaningful. So what do you think that is this point to?
Yes, I think, let me put in this way. First, yes, what you thought, shared by many, including myself, like we believe that yes, maybe Putin want to carry in into, you know, the eastern parts of Ukraine, doesn't want to go to the west, but he started bombarding, you know, the western parts of Ukraine. Like my family is now just next to the Polish border, and they go to the shelter all the time because of the sirens. You know, he sends his unmanned aircrafts and his planes to as far as to the Polish border, very close. And who knows what will happen? Well, one moment they may cross the, you know, airborne space of the NATO. It may happen anytime, and it is very plausible now. What I think, yes, what I want to stress in line with your reflection, with your question, is that yes, Putin is pragmatic. You know, there was a joke, and I told this joke myself, that there are three things in which people in the Kremlin believe. One thing is money, another thing is money, and guess what is the third thing? The money, again. And this money pragmatism, this neoliberal, essentially, even though probably they don't know the word and the, you know, the concept, but this is a very neoliberal approach, which some European countries demonstrate nowadays, like Germany, I believe. I don't want to point the finger, but I have to sometimes. Putin is a neoliberal in this regard, very pragmatic. At the same time, he is a fatalist. This sort of Russian fatalist that described by, you know, by Lermontov, I don't know, you know, those Russian poets, who, yes, they seem to be all right, like doing very good career, like officers, like in Lermontov's poems pieces. And then they like go and shoot themselves, you know, and destroy the world around them. Putin does it on the global scale. And I think another thing that we can say about him, that he is, he believes in ideas and he's framed by ideas. He is an ideocratic person. He has ideocracy in the sense, yes, that yes, he has ideas which go beyond his interests, like pragmatic interests. And more dangerously, those ideas possess him. It's not that he, you know, operates ideas. The problem is that the ideas operate him. And this is a kind of ideocracy which crazily, schizophrenically, coexists with his ultimate pragmatism, with his neoliberal kind of approach to things, and which makes him dangerous, really. But I think it is necessarily to understand this ideological frame that possesses him, because then he becomes more predictable.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I think this is an excellent interview. At this point, we will stop this to save your time, and we'll let you know how it will go and on, and how we'll record it and when it's published and etc. So thank you so much, Professor Schmidt, for finding time for talking to us today. And we will be discussing mainly the questions which are, what is bigger picture of this war? What does it mean for the region? What does it mean for the Europe at large? But also your knowledge of history, of ideas, and of a broader geopolitical context, which are very important, and also some elements of Putin's biography, which you can tell us. And I think we'll start from your estimation of the ongoing crisis. How do you see it? What is it, and what's the nature of it, and what will be the potential scenarios which we can have a conversation about? And then we can gradually get into a more historical context, which kind of stipulated where we're at, and maybe the role of Putin's personality, and maybe his kind of ideas, the way he sees Russia and Russia in the bigger context.
Well, I think what we witnessed on Thursday is a historical threshold. I think a new era has begun. I would compare it in its importance to the demise of the Soviet Union. Russia will never be the same as it was before. And I see mainly two points. The first point is that Russia, from now on, at least under Putin's presidency, will be a pariah state. It will be completely isolated in the international sphere. And the second point is the social contract in Russia is deeply broken. Maybe the population hasn't found out about this yet, but I think it will wake up to reality very soon. And in a way, I think this could really change the not only the stability, the relative stability in the region, but it can have very grave consequences for Russia itself.
And can you tell us more about this, you know, historical context, or maybe the setting under which Putin operates? You mentioned in the biography of Putin a few interesting episodes. So what kind of ideas shaped this man to become who he is? And where does this whole thing leads us all to?
Yes, it's known that Putin grew up in the backyards of Leningrad, and with a certain pride, he said in autobiographical interviews that were published already back in 1999 that he was a rowdy. And I think he, well, grew up in a framework where rules were important. So, for instance, he did judo and boxing. And at the same time, he was also someone who always broke the rules. And then when he got his education as a secret service agent, he was trained, as he proudly remarks in a recent TV film, he was trained in both legal and illegal activities. So there is not a red line for him between what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And I also have to say, I had to revise my picture of Putin completely after February 24th, because so far I thought that his seemingly irrational behavior is the result of a rational calculus. So that he basically tried to make the whole world believe that he's mad enough really to invade Ukraine. And at the same time, I think it is clear, even if we just look at the situation unfolding now in Ukraine, that this is a lose-lose situation. Ukraine is in a bloody chaos, and Russia is deeply isolated, will be economically ruined, and politically, basically, it will transform into an open dictatorship.
And I was wondering if you consider this scenario, and I know you're definitely share also my skepticism to futurism and all of that, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the potential calculation behind this isolation in a way. Maybe he just wanted the North Korean sort of model instead of, you know, having this kind of double standards and here and there kind of having negotiation space with the West, but also disagreements and doing politics the way he was doing before. Rather than that, he was like, well, let's go give it a go and be like completely isolated, and let's put blood on everybody's hands in this Federal Council or this FSB people, and build this kind of the pyramid, which is isolating and really military dictatorship-like, which is in hands of a few Slavic henchmen, his minions, who are ready to do anything. And if people die, well, we have moving crematoriums along, as the Guardian and I think Telegraph reported. So people doesn't matter. What matters is power at any cost. And having nuclear weapons allowed North Korea to exist in such setting, in poverty and desperate. And why would it not be the model? Why would he not consider that, having like European Afghanistan in Ukraine, people dying, suffering, is his resource enough to sustain the North Korean sort of political model?
Well, what we're witnessing right now is probably the result of a deep miscalculation. I think he thought that on February 25th, the Russian army will parade through Kiev, and the people from Kiev would applaud the alleged liberators. Of course, we know that exactly the opposite is happening. What you mentioned with this isolation, I think in hindsight, we really have to say this is what he wanted. He knew exactly what was going to happen. He knew what the price tag for his action would be. I think both the American and the European leaders had made very clear that sanctions would be unprecedented, and unprecedented they are, in fact, right now. And I think, in a way, my personal revision is the following. I always thought of Putin as someone who thinks tactically. And now I get the impression that he's deeply directed and governed by ideology. And I think this isolation has been prepared by certain conservative thinkers in Russia, for instance, like Tsimbursky, who came up with the conception of the island Russia. And then, of course, there were other people like Mikhail Leontiev, who came up with the conception of the fortress Russia. And in a way, I think this is somehow like a materialization of Samuel Huntington's famous conception of the clash of cultures, which was read in Moscow with enthusiasm. And from a Moscovian perspective, this was not an interpretation of history, but it was rather a manual, a political manual of how to proceed in the future. And I think what we see right now is the attempt to establish such a splendid isolation for Russia, which would, in the end, in Putin's view, be one of the three centers of power of the world. US is one, Russia is the second, and China is the third.
Do you think it has a chance? I mean, realistically, Putin, I mean, people who knew him well, like people like Pugachev and Khodorkovsky, were really all over internet and interviewing. And they said that, well, he's this weird guy who actually believes in things. Maybe these are really like, he believes it on the early morning of the day and he doesn't at the end of the day. But when he actually means something, he really is driven by ideas. So it's not so much this well-calculated. But at some point, it's just like almost a fundamentalist belief in that Ukrainian people, as you say, will greet him with flowers as a liberator from Nazism or whatever. And having that in mind, I wonder what sort of options we have now in a global context. What does it really mean? And how can the Western allied forces or whatever we can talk can deal with this problem? With his mindset, and which are the costs really? What is he able to do? I mean, sacrificing so much of the Russian international respect or Russian economy, as you say, and we know already numbers that it's going to 90s default. There's going to be a crazy impact on the Russian economy by any measurable mean. So what sort of future does that give to Putin's regime? Can he even sustain this North Korean isolation? Can he be without this Western cash to do somehow along the lines of North Korea? But North Korea still has China in it. North Korea has China, which is sponsor and key provider. But who will do that for Russia?
Well, Russia doesn't want to have any sponsor. Russia, in Putin's view, is a self-sufficient center of power. And I think one fatal experience, also in hindsight, is the fact that the surrogate of imports worked relatively well after 2014. You remember the West imposed sanctions upon Russia after the annexation of Crimea, and Russia answered with counter sanctions. Sanctions, which basically touched the realm of food. And so in a way, this was a way to protect the domestic Russian economy, and maybe Putin and his entourage drew the conclusion from that that Russia is big enough to be a self-sufficient market. What will happen in the future? I don't see any possible positive future. And I'm shocked because I think this was foreseeable, would have been foreseeable for the leadership in the Kremlin if they only had eyes to see. But they didn't have eyes to see because, as you say, they were completely blinded by ideology. And I self-critically have to say, until Wednesday, I thought that ideology is something that Putin toys with. This is just an instrument in his hands, and sometimes he believes in ideological concepts, sometimes he doesn't. But I think this has fundamentally changed on Thursday, when it really became clear that the restoration of what he calls historical Russia is for him such an absolute good that he is willing to sacrifice Ukraine. He is willing to sacrifice the welfare of his people. He is willing to sacrifice Russia's position in the world. So I think he's completely blindfolded by ideology. And I see basically three scenarios for the future. One scenario could be called the Georgian scenario, which seemed to be, for me, the most probable scenario for exactly one week ago, for me Monday. Too. Yeah, so that he would recognize Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic, and eventually they would be a member of the Russian Federation. I think this option is off the table now, because I think it's impossible that Russia will voluntarily withdraw its troops. So this is the minimum scenario. The maximal scenario is what I would call the Chechen scenario. So a complete occupation of whole Ukraine, and basically the whole Ukraine with its region also would become some kind of a military protectorate of the Russian Federation. This is also very unlikely, in my view, just because of the simple reason that Russia, even with a lot more of soldiers on the ground, won't be able to occupy Ukraine. You remember probably Igor Girkin, Strelkov, and he recently said in an interview, and he's someone who has to know it, although he is a very dubious figure, he said, for each soldier that Russia sends in just to conquer Ukraine, they need to send in 10 additional soldiers just to keep the occupation of Ukraine. And then there is a middle scenario, which I would call the Transnistrian scenario, so that part of Ukraine will be, well, I don't know if occupied is the right word, but that there will be some kind of a puppet regime in Kiev that doesn't control the whole territory of today's Ukraine, and Ukraine will depend completely from Moscow. But also this is not a viable scenario. So wherever I look, I only see chaos.
And the very cynical question would be, maybe Putin has a plan for chaos. Maybe he's the guy that actually knows how to manage this chaos, because the idea that if everybody is in this chaos, who are, but not we, know how to manage this chaos and this Bespridel, as he calls a kind of this the sets of rules, which is like kind of organized chaos in a way, but he knows how to deal with that. Again, I'm not in the position of portraying him as this kind of wise man that has such strategy under every Machiavellian move, but I'm thinking about this also in the long term, like what it means for the entire region, for Europe, this whole Chechen front on Ukraine, the Chechnya of 21st century, or even Afghanistan, depending on the scale. I mean, today, Yuval Noah Harari wrote in The Guardian about this kind of feelings of hatred, and how much of this is in a way a hidden treasure for resistance, and how can this venomous nationalism can sustain resistance for generations. And then pretty much Putin kind of signed the death certificate of the Russian Federation as the argument went. So I'm wondering what it means for Europe at large, and what kind of rules of the game will we see, what it means for Caucasus. Is there a potential scenario that if Ukraine is off the table and if it's in this chaos, the next will be Georgia or the next will be any other neighboring country? Why not? If this works, if this chaos works, well, let them go back to the, I don't know, medieval centuries. Because at the end of the day, it is about this sort of idea, right, which is so kind of into this. So I wonder if you consider this response, to what extent this European response solves the problem, and how can it even solve this in the long run, and what it means to the region at large.
Well, you mentioned chaos in Ukraine as a goal in itself. I think that may hold true for Syria. I think there, of course, the creation of chaos was a goal in itself. I don't think that this scenario is applicable to Ukraine because, as I said, I think that Putin deeply believes in his own ideology, in the tree, in the trinity of the three Eastern Slavic peoples. And actually, he is still, and I think this became very clear in the last 2 days, he still wants to keep what he considers to be Russia's soft power. Well, patriotism, family, anti-LGBT, everything that, as the official document that defines the Russian cultural policy from 2015 states, as what the vast majority of mankind considers to be normal. So he thinks that, basically, as Dostoevsky would say it, the light will come from the East, and especially in Russia. And Russia is a role model for a new civilization that will enlighten eventually the whole rest of the world. What does it mean for Europe? Well, I think if this state that we're in right now will continue for several years or even decades, it will probably mean that Russia will cut all links to Western Europe, and will try to define its own rules within a society. And so I think that's really a horrible scenario. Maybe we will also see something like an invisible Chinese wall arise between, well, Western Europe and Russia without any contact, and I think that's a very sad scenario.
And the last question would be, do you consider that his inner circle is somewhat, you know, agreeing with this? Again, I mean, we can't of course speculate what happens in the closed doors behind Kremlin, but I mean, from the bodily expressions, I was like, this Shoigu and this people, like FSB people, or this Naryshkin, the guy was like,
oh yes,
technically, that was this kind of lost guy in the middle of a conversation, and then Putin was forcing him to just speak out, and he was just this lost man, like not knowing what to tell, as if they were not even sure what exactly he expects them to tell them, and then whatever he was expecting, they were trying to get into this. So what kind of entourage, what would they feel? I mean, they would care about their billions, about their children. Definitely, probably there is this conflict. So one plot, of course, is this kind of potential Stalin's plot, right? This kind of death of the dictator in this random setting, which FSB is, again, you know, expert in how to organize. We can't obviously speculate that. But in terms of the clashes of interest, there were arrests of the Minister of Economy or other people, very influential people get into the jail. So everybody fears for their own self. But in that setting, the stakes are so high, as you say, there is like absolutely no good scenario at all. So what potentially can get into his inner circle, or Chechens and Siloviki, Dacha people, these billionaires? What kind of clashes shall we think of, if there is any sort of sign, of course, from the limited information we know?
Well, we know from research in political science that an autocrat can be ousted most probably then when there is a defection of the elites. I don't really see that happening, and I think Putin very well knows how to stage his policies, how to stage his decisions, and it is not by chance that this session of the Security Council was aired, because the session of this Security Council didn't have the purpose to deliberate upon what is going to happen, but the purpose was to show the outside world that Putin is in charge, and that everybody around him has only one task: to find out what is in Putin's head and what he really wants, and well, to accommodate to that will. I think that also in this recent video that showed Putin with Shoigu and Gerasimov, when he threatened with nuclear weapons, was full of symbolics. Because as we know, in order to launch the Russian nuclear arms, you need three people to concur: the president, the minister of defense, and the chief of staff. And so exactly these three people were present. Only one person spoke. And I think it's completely clear that also here, Putin wanted to show, I can push the red button if I want. And these two guys next to me, they will do whatever I want without, well, hesitation. So I think there is also one problem here that, well, the entourage of Putin has been fortified over the last 20 years. Loyalty has become the most important element of if you wanted to have a career in that system. And I think we see the deplorable results of such human resource policy now in the Kremlin.
Yeah, well, hopefully let's keep our fingers crossed that he will not press that button, and we will still be able to analyze things. And thank you very much for your time, Professor Smith.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for finding time to speak with us, Dr. Elsner, and we'll have a lot to speak. And one of the most important things today is to make a theological sense of what's going on. And I'm wondering what your takeaway from this whole thing is. Russian church's response throughout this time, since the day of invasion. How do you think, how do you explain, how do you kind of understand the whole theological part behind, if any, is there? And what's the nature of the religious response in a way? And what's the future of that? So this will be the themes which we'll cover, and you can start from whichever question you feel comfortable.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me. Yes, I think, in fact, we see several dimensions going on in this church field and religious field in this war. And one which has been already talked a lot about is the ideological dimension, is the question how the Russian Orthodox Church pushed and boosted the ideological dimension of this war, thinking about Russian world concepts and protection of persecuted Christians and so on. So this is one dimension, but I would like to use our talk to also draw attention to the more pastoral or spiritual dimension, which is something that somehow triggered me much more during the last days when looking at the sermons of Patriarch Kirill and how he is reacting. It was one of my first reactions in the first days of the war, when I was really embarrassed about the fact that he does not take pastoral responsibility for his flock in Ukraine. So you have the situation that for now, for I think 10 or 20 years, we hear all the time about how he feels responsible for Ukrainian faithful, for the believers of his church, for the Metropolitan Onufri and so on. And now we see this horrible war going on, being absolutely blind in relation to what confession, religion, or other things people confess or believe or want to live for in Ukraine. The war just murders them all. And Kirill is silent on this. And this is really a dimension we have to look into deeper from a theological point of view. And the sermons he held during the last days, they were quite eye-opening in this dimension, I think. Because yeah, we saw in this sermons, we also saw, of course, this ideology, this talk about unity and about defending faith, defending our values and so on, those dualistic worldview. And of course, this is also present and important. But from my point of view, what also counts a lot is how he, in my view, abuses his spiritual responsibility in relation to his flock in Russia as well as in Ukraine. So this is something I would be also happy to talk about.
Yeah, and this is a very important question. Like, how is that justified theologically? Like, well, how can you get away, in a way, from the people in our audience who may not be familiar with Orthodox theology? And for like a broader audience, how would you get away in sense from this kind of response, theologically speaking, and in front of God, and when the main pastor is basically saying, well, that's sort of the punishment for being your behavior or lifestyle, whatever. It's the way we kind of can interpret his very controversial statement. So I'm wondering, where does it lead in a theological sense to the church and the future of this church in Ukraine? But first of all, I would appreciate your thoughts on this. Like, how is it even actually making sense? How is it justified theologically? This whole dynamics of leaving your flock in this kind of area of a humanitarian catastrophe, not mentioning anything about that, and somewhat closing eyes on the very, very grave crimes.
I have no really words or answers for this, because in my point of view and from my Christian point of view, this is unchristian what he is doing. This is you can't justify or somehow legitimate all this from a Christian point of view. But what helps me to understand what is going on here is something we have been discussing in Germany for quite a long time now. And in our Catholic context, in fact, and this is the concept of spiritual abuse. And this is not just a big concept or idea or coining a term for what is going on, but this has really a theological dimension that a pastor is using his spiritual responsibility to manipulate with truth. In fact, with an understanding of truth, we see a lot of lies, of open lies in his sermons from Patriarch Kirill. He's manipulating with the Orthodox understanding of obedience, because we don't have this in our Western churches anymore, that in that dimension, that people really are have an understanding of being obedient to the spiritual leader, to an elder, to a pastor who will say what is right and what is wrong. And for the Russian flock and for the Ukrainian flock as well, this is really important to have such a leader they can count on, and they really adore in their perception. They know that he will say the truth, and Kirill manipulates this understanding of obedience in a very cruel way, in fact. And he's also manipulating very much with this understanding of good and evil. He is building up a world where there's nothing in between. You have evil on the one side and you have the good on the other side. And he's straightly forward bullying all people who don't fit into this black and white picture. So everyone who would dare to not consent, who would dare to dissent with what Kirill is telling about evil and good, is out of the game, is not perceived as a human being worth attention from the church, in fact. So this is really a deep spiritual outreach in understanding how he understands his pastoral mission or responsibility. And what would be interesting to see, but that is more to the Orthodox, in fact, than to me as a Catholic theologian, is what can we make in understanding of church and of ecclesial power and of ecclesial relationships? What can you make out of it? Because we saw already people claiming that that he is heretic, and that when we have this discussion in Ukraine already about not commemorating Kirill, so excluding his name from the liturgy, there's already the discussion about, is this possible from a canonical point of view? And is this heretical what he is doing? And it is, of course, not a violation of dogma, but it is a really serious violation of spiritual responsibility of a pastor. So have we some theological measures, instruments to somehow assess this violation? I'm not sure about it. It would be a question to Orthodox fellows, in fact.
So is there a way in which this can be kind of brought to the Orthodox tribunal, if you will, in a way like moral, ethical tribunal, in which you can basically ask questions? So why were you silent when kids were murdered and the Russian military invasion, which killed so many innocent people? Why was that justified in a way through your... So who is the authority to even ask these questions in such autonomous settings? Because these churches are autocephalous, for those of us who are from studying this region, we know, but for the wider audience, well, Orthodox churches do not have a pope. There is no one single kind of ruling authority. They are very decentralized, and each of the patriarchs has a very big authority in their own country, in all their kind of sphere, spiritual territory, if you will. So who is even yet to ask these questions? Is there a kind of a council potentially that can ask Kirill these tough questions, or is it more like a normative thing that it will be polarized from, and he will be isolated in the eyes of other churches? And in general, what was the reaction, if you observed, of other churches towards that ongoing issue, or towards maybe Kirill's view of this war?
Mm-hmm. Now, we definitely see a problem in those canonical questions in Orthodoxy, and we see it not only in this case now. This is a long-lasting history about not being able to define those canonical structures in Orthodoxy, who is able to take such decisions. And so this is just another and the next case for debating within Orthodoxy this question. But of course, it is a normative question. And of course, we will see, and we already see, that churches divide and faithful divide on this line of respecting the authority of Patriarch Kirill, or dismissing him, or criticizing him for this pastoral lack. But in fact, I have to say that I, at the moment, see more reactions to his political entanglement and to this political ideological framework work. And I don't see so much reaction to this ethical and pastoral issue from other Orthodox churches. And this also points a little bit to the problem we have seen all the last years, in fact, that we have this discussion about political Orthodoxy, about nationalism and political political structures within the church and so on. But the debate about ethical issues and about ethical behavior of a church, of its leadership, is not so in the focus. And this, of course, has to be discussed. And another topic which is obvious here is, of course, the question of power. And we have this question of power and of, if I may say so, male power. We have it in all churches at the moment. We have it in the Catholic Church very much. And we have it also, we see it here in Orthodox Church, that one man is able to define and to manipulate what means truth, what is Orthodoxy, what is faith about. And you have no really structures or possibilities that someone will answer him to this, and someone may discuss it with him. And this is, of course, also a problem of a sermon. He is very decisively, I think, choosing this format. He does not make statements or something like that. He gives a sermon, and a sermon in a church is something you won't discuss with someone. And this is in this unequal power relations, you have no possibility from someone to dissent with what he is saying. So we have to, of course, also talk about power relations in church and about those abusing structures we have and we see in this now in this situation very very horrible, in a very horrible form.
And some of us were, you know, in sociology or political sociology, were, you know, examining the idea of Russian world in depth, and then looking at how it works on level of ground and on the level of grassroots responses, and how geopolitical processes, how they were shaped in a way by this idea. Do you see this reemergence of this Russian world idea in the war? And was that sort of the something which one might could have probably seen, that really is the Russian Orthodox Church, as the argument goes, is part of the Kremlin's foreign policy influence? That's kind of the conventional sort of observation. Some people argue that it's idea, more like preserving Russian culture. I was saying that it's more like hybrid of idea, ideology, and a geopolitical project, and it's used in situational contexts. But today we see that Kirill is basically following the Kremlin's line. One question is, could he have done otherwise, given the power relationships in Russia? And what could have been the potential consequence for that? Because, I mean, he's a very powerful man himself. We can't just completely ignore the role of agents here. And in a way, and when the years will come and maybe some scholars analyze, we probably can't necessarily reflect that he didn't have other choices. I mean, he had choices because he's an incredibly powerful status. And even if he would have suffered probably from persecution, which he as a Christian wouldn't have necessarily be afraid of, this could have left a different kind of legacy in his name. But he didn't. He chose the way he did. And so question is, would you comment on the power relationships from your observation between the Russian Church and Kremlin? Is that a kind of the submissive story that we're seeing, that basically is Russian Orthodox Church is kind of submissive to the Kremlin? Absolutely. Or it's kind of maybe the ideological cocktail in which they are the same. They share the worldviews. And you already reflected on the theological dimension that doesn't make sense theologically, but whatever, I hate to say geopolitically, but geopolitically it kind of gives the reason if you look at the Russian world ideology.
Yes, indeed. And I absolutely agree with your second interpretation. I was never reasoning about Kirill don't having a chance or having a choice and not being able to define what he was talking about. This is a joint project. This is a joint ideology in which both sides have a lot to win for themselves. They also have a lot to lose, but they are not thinking about it seems so what they are losing. But if we look for the last 10 years at least since the famous and conservative turn of Vladimir Putin in 2012, we see how both construct together this ideology built on this Russian world concept and on the idea that Russia has a mission going far beyond its own borders in disseminating this value concept and this idea of conservative statehood and so on. So this is joint, and this is Kirill, and this is his choice. And I won't take anything or give anything to defend him in any way that he would not have a choice in this direction. But what is interesting in my observation is that this joint project suffered a really crucial crisis with the annexation of Crimea, because until then, there has also always been their work in this project. So the Patriarch was always eager to say that we respect national borders, and of course we have this spiritual dimension of unity, but the national borders are fixed and we won't touch them. And Putin touched them. And this was for Kirill really a crisis. And of this relationship. And what we have seen after this is that this concept of Russian world, it somehow vanished from the forefront. I wouldn't say that it is not active anymore in the background, but they don't use it in an offensive way anymore. And that points, and Christina Stöckel also talked about this, the Russian Orthodox Church after this getting more national and a little bit decreasing the power of this transnational agenda they have had with this Russian world concept. But what we see at the same time is this is an increasing agenda on defending persecuted Christians and being the defender of everything good defined by the patriarch in this world, and fighting everything bad in this definition. And this got stronger, and this now has really, with this war, also get some new dimension and power in this political sphere. It's of course further about this unity of in a geographically defined meaning, but we should really not ignore the global dimension behind this idea of defending persecuted Christians or persecuted people. This is something new we should not underestimate in this global agenda, I think. And it has another outreach than this Russian world concept, which is quite focused on a geographical sphere.
And if we look at Putin's address, this the first one, in which he refers to some very mysterious in understanding of history, very inaccurate, of course. And he, you know, it refers to the, you know, persecution of Orthodox churches there, etc. So in a way, this religious component was there, and in some form in Putin's rhetoric that vanished after the war tremendously because of obvious reasons that they were bombing, including some of the churches were hit, and the two Orthodox where churches were pretty much in this kind of involved on as sides to the conflict, and I'm wondering what you make of the Onofre's responses, who's a metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, who compared the war to Cain's war against Abel, and this allegory was very popular. But again, some people started to criticize that it was a bit belated response because it was years of silence and kind of neutrality and etc. So I'm wondering, and maybe we're kind of going gradually to the final parts, what do you make of this relationships? Is the Russian church over in Ukraine? We will not see the Metropolitanate of Ukraine in some form, and this is that's it, you can't get out of this anymore?
This is at the moment very difficult to say, it seems to me, because we have a really great dynamics and going on in Ukraine and in Ukraine Orthodoxy. Onufri and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate has had really a hard stand during the last years and during the last weeks especially, because it was torn from the inside about this conflict between Russia and Ukrainian and Ukrainian identity and Russian influence. And we have seen a lot of conflicts in this sphere, in this dimension during the last years. And a lot of propaganda and a lot of instrumentalization taking place from both sides, or from all three sides, I would say. what we see now is that the church, that believers, faithful bishops already turned their back to Russia because of this lack of pastoral responsibility from Kirill, who was just ignoring what is going on. And I'm sure, by the way, that he, of course, knows everything what is going on in Ukraine, and that he, nevertheless, is not able to say any word about this, and just doing, painting a picture where just the bad West is going to destroy everything. This is really, really awful to watch this scene. And the Ukrainians are very much aware of it, and they pled for help to Ukraine, to Kirill. They asked him to support, to take, to do at least some statement on what is going on with its own Christians and own believers in Ukraine, and he does not. So they will turn their back to him, and there will be a lot of Christians, a lot of faithful, not returning to Russian Orthodoxy anymore. But we see also that Onufri is very hesitant to make any decisive steps in this direction. And this is, on the one side, due to the huge history of mistrust and propaganda going on in Ukraine for now quite a long time against his church. And it is, of course, also due to his dependence from Moscow in many ways. And it is also maybe a third one, it is, of course, also due to his responsibility to the faithful in his church, which are by now not able to turn their back to Russia by different reasons, maybe. But he is also there. Pastor. So he tries to stand with them. But his words about Cain and the murder and the sin of Cain, is, I think they have a very heavy weight in all this discussion. and they have to be taken seriously in this debate. Everything depends on how the war will go, in fact, with the churches, because if Russia will win and will take the lead in this on this territory of Ukraine, then of course all other Christian denominations apart from the this Ukrainian Orthodox Church, they will just vanish from the from the landscape of Ukraine in this sense, and also the Ukrainian Orthodox Church will probably be just cleaned up from all those bishops and priests and faithful who turned their back to Russia. If this won't be the case, then maybe there will be a very little branch of Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine. Maybe they will have a chance to survive. But of course, they will have a really hard time to defend their position in this war and the Russian Orthodox position in this war, in fact.
And the last one would be, what was the role, was the kind of response of the Catholic Church to the ongoing situation? How do you think this conflict or Russian Orthodox Church's positionality affect the relationship between Catholics and Orthodox?
And this is also very interesting, because of course the Catholic Church and most prominently the Pope Francis is taking a very decisive stance for peace and against the war. And the Pope also, after some time of hesitating, called the aggressor by its name and called Putin and the Russian army and what is going on in Ukraine, which is important in terms also of future reconciliation and peacemaking, to name the aggressor. But what I see is now we have a discussion in ecumenical relations how to go on with Russian Orthodoxy and with the Russian Orthodox Church. And there are voices who demand that Russian Orthodoxy has to be kicked out from ecumenical structures, from the World Council of Churches, or from the official dialogues between different Catholic churches. And I'm a little bit hesitant about this, because first, a dialogue is always more than just talking between the hierarchy and taking seriously a patriarch, but it is also about connections on the lower level, and this would be important in future to maintain this. And the other point is that the Catholic Church has been one of the main allies in this ideology Patriarch Kirill is telling about and is working on. And as long as the Catholic Church is not able to distance itself in this value debate, in this black and white and liberal and anti-liberal forces discussion, it won't be possible to take a really decisive and authentical stance and in this debate, and to distance from being an ally with the Russian Orthodox Church and this ideology. So this would be more crucial than for now, I think, than debating about how to talk with him any further. At the moment, he is not interested in talking with anyone, in fact. And I think this is a secondary question, how we will talk with him in future ecumenical relations.
Regina Elsner, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.